I'm Siri, and this is True Crime Minutes. This show contains depiction of violent crimes and may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener's discretion is advised. Hey everyone, I'm sorry for being the most inconsistent podcaster out there. As some of you may know, I had a baby in January, and this little guy is keeping me super busy. I also have a full-time job and two side hustles, and I also often get lost in my research and then overwhelmed. I really wish I could tell you I will have a new episode every week, but I think the most realistic plan is probably to get a regular episode every month and a mini in between. I wanted to cover this case for a while, but now is probably the best time to do it, since it is everywhere in the news. You have probably all heard of Donald Trump and his Attorney General William Barr's killing spree with 10 federal executions since July 2020, and 3 to come before handover of power to Biden. Lisa Montgomery is scheduled to die only 8 days before that. If it happens, she will be the first woman executed by the federal government in almost 70 years. She is actually the only woman on federal death row. So we know she's there, and we know she's scheduled to die. But what crime brought her there? In 2004, Bobby Justinet is a 23-year-old woman. She has been married to her high school sweetheart, Zeb, for a year, and the couple is expecting their first child, a little girl. Bobby Jo is close to her parents. She is sweet, caring, and trusting. She loves dogs. More precisely, Rat Terrier, that she breeds with her husband at her home for extra money. She participates in contests, and she is a member of an online message board dedicated to them called Rat Chatter. She starts a friendship with Lisa Montgomery, 36-year-old, another member of the forum who is also pregnant. The two women actually met briefly before the same year at a dog show. You can see a picture of them together online. I will post it on the site and the social media. But it's really their common pregnancies that bring them together. Lisa explains she was pregnant with twins but lost one of them. She's expecting to give birth to a survivor twin in January 2005. Bobby Jo is 8 months pregnant herself at the time, so the two have very close due dates. The two women exchange emails about their pregnancies, baby gear, baby names. Only, unbeknownst to her own husband, Lisa's pregnancy was fake. She actually had a tubal litigation after the last of her 4 children was born prematurely, because the doctors didn't think she would be able to carry another baby to term. Around the same time, another breeder and member of the forum, Jason Dawson, receives an email from a Darling Fisher with the username Fisher for Kids, inquiring about puppies up for adoption in northern Missouri. Darlene, being from Fairfax, Missouri, he recommends Bobby Jo, who recently had a litter. She gets in touch with Bobby Jo and they arrange a meeting at Bobby Jo's farmhouse in Skidmore, Missouri. On December 16, 2004, at 2:30 p.m., Bobby Jo is on the phone with her mother, Becky Harper, and tells her mom she has a potential buyer here and she needs to go. An hour later that day, Bobby Jo's mother comes to her house. The front door is open, and her daughter is not responding to her calls. Becky Harper lets herself in and finds her daughter lying on the floor in a pool of blood. She has been beaten, her face is bruised, she has ligature marks on her neck and a gaping wound in the abdomen. There were still strands of blonde hair clenched in Bobby Jo's fists. Becky immediately calls 911 and tells the operator that her daughter is 8 months pregnant and that Bobby Joe's abdomen looks like it has exploded. Her stomach has been sliced open and her baby is missing. Paramedics rush to the scene and attempt to revive her, but everything fails and she is pronounced dead at the hospital at 4:27 p.m. The doctors declare that the missing baby, however, might still be alive despite a traumatic birth. The police worry she might already have been taken across state line. Despite her basic information being unknown, an Amber Alert is issued and the FBI gets involved. Around the same time, in Kansas, Lisa Montgomery calls her husband Kevin to let him know she delivered their daughter at the Birth and Women's Center in Topeka, Kansas, after she went into labor while shopping. Lisa already has 4 children from a previous marriage, but this is Kevin's first child. So I guess he doesn't really know much about pregnancy, labor, or delivery, because he buys the full story and comes pick her up with her teenagers in a parking lot near the clinic. Lisa and the baby gets in Kevin's truck, and the teens drive her car, and the family and the new addition go home in Malvern, Kansas. The Montgomerys call their friends and families to announce the birth of their child. They spend the night next to a bassinet in the living room. They are so happy. The next day, the couple is showing up their new baby girl with the name Abigail all over town. They run errands with her, go have breakfast. People are shocked to see the baby because they did not believe Lisa was really pregnant. She did not look pregnant at all. However, the whole family is delighted and enjoying the newborn. After hearing Becky Harper's recollection of the events and timeline, and a neighbor's sighting of an old red dirty car in Bobby Joe's driveway around the same time she was on the phone, it is pretty clear to the investigators that their main suspect is the woman who showed up that afternoon under the false pretense of buying a puppy. The news of Bobby Joe's murder spreads quickly on the Radar Chatter forum, and one user, Diane Sikhtar, starts her own investigation. She goes over past messages and comes across a conversation between Bobby Joe and Darlene Fisher about meeting on the exact day Bobby Joe was killed. Bobby Joe's last message to Darlene was that she had emailed her address and direction to her house. A little creeped out by Darlene's username, remember it's Fisher for Kids, she decides to contact the police to mention her discovery. They are obviously right away interested in finding this Darlene Fisher, since she is either potential witness of clues of some sort, or the killer. Based on the information available on her, the police quickly realize that Darlene Fisher does not exist, at least not in Fairfax, Missouri, where she pretended to be from. Whoever that person is, they are using a fake name. Their next step is to trace her emails. Diane Sikhtar could provide the police with the time of the last email exchange between 5:37 and 5:57 p.m. on December 15, 2004, in addition to the IP address used by Darlene Fisher. With that, they are able to determine who is the internet provider. It was Quest Communication. And a security specialist at this company is able to find that the server used that day was located in Topeka, Kansas, at the time of the email exchange was assigned to Kevin Montgomery's landline number in Malvern, Kansas. Law enforcement officers conduct a surveillance at the address of the residence linked to the phone number. As soon as the officers showed up to the address, the mystery seems pretty much solved. The dirty red car pulled up in front of the house. When they get to the door and when Kevin let them in, Lisa is on the couch holding a newborn baby. Lisa serves them the exact same story she told Kevin about going into labor while shopping out of town the previous day. It is quickly verified that no baby was delivered at this birth center on the 16th. The detectives isolate Lisa to talk to her, and after hearing they know she is lying, she changes her story. She first says that unbeknownst to her husband, she had given birth at home in the kitchen. Finally, Lisa breaks down and confesses the murder and the kidnapping. Listen to Officer Randy Strong recalling the arrest.
My guise was that we're here looking for witnesses and maybe you can help us. When I walked through the door, our Amber Alert was displaying on the TV right in front of me. And I turned to my right. The house was very cluttered, it was hard to take in. It wasn't real well lit. And I turned to the right and she's sitting on the sofa to my immediate right holding a baby.
She was real quiet, timid, I'd say.
She told us that she had had the baby at a women's clinic and a birthing clinic in Topeka, Kansas, of course, and that she'd had Kevin drive up and bring her back home, had her daughter come with Kevin and take the car back home. I mentioned Bobby Joe's name, and I told her that we knew that she knew her, and she said, "Bobby Joe who?" So I want to get her separated from the baby. We can't see her hands.
Detective Strong at that time asked if he could hold the baby. And she said, "Yeah, sure." She was almost like she was trying to be, "I'm proud of my baby. Yeah, you can look at my baby."
I was a little unnerved by the baby. I knew it was a month premature. And the baby didn't cry. There was no sound coming from the baby, but I could see its color was good and it was breathing. I asked her, I said, "Would you come out and let me interview you?" And she got up and come out with me. And we went outside and sat in the car, and then we just started talking.
We went to a satellite station that the sheriff's office had where we could talk to her.
She was difficult because she had absolutely no remorse.
She never at any time said, "I'm sorry for what I did."
We kind of had to switch gears and just, like, we are here. We know that that's our baby.
She didn't like Randy because Randy was pressuring her. I thought, "Man, I'm just going to lay low and, you know, soothe into it." I think she did kind of confide in me.
We started getting bits and pieces of it, and then eventually she started talking.
At one point, I just slid my chair just right up against her chair, my knees right by her knees, retched out, and she put her hand in my hand and I put my other hand on top of it. Well, I happened to look down then, and I could see blood still underneath her fingernails.
She eventually said, "You have your baby," and that was kind of her first step. She said, "I took the baby out and cut the cord and I clamped it with my fingers and I stuck the baby in my coat and I went out to my car and drove a ways away, and I stopped and she got a baby seat out of the car and she got Huck's towels to wipe the baby off and she brought a bulb syringe to suction the baby out." When she starts telling you all this, you realize that you now have a first degree homicide on your hands. This was planned.
After the baby is found, she is examined by healthcare professionals. DNA testing proves that she is Bobby Joe's, and she is finally returned to her father, Zeb Stinnett, and named Victoria Joe. But what exactly happened at Bobby Joe's house, and who is really Lisa Montgomery? When Bobby Joe's answered the door at 12:30 p.m. on December 16, 2004, she did not face a complete stranger. Darling Fisher was really Lisa Montgomery, and the two women had met briefly before, that year at a dog show. Remember the picture that I was telling you about. Prosecution thinks this is how Lisa knew Bobby Joe was pregnant and what triggered her plan to steal her baby, but this is only speculation as far as I know. The woman brought the puppies outside and played with them until Bobby Joe received a call from her mother. After she hung the phone, Lisa Montgomery attacked Bobby Joe and used the cord she kept in her pocket to strangle her from behind until she was unconscious. Lisa then pushed her onto her back on the floor, then used a kitchen knife to cut into her abdomen, causing Bobby Joe to regain consciousness. A struggle ensued, and while bleeding profusely, Bobby Joe tried desperately to save herself and her daughter. Lisa strangled her a second time, killing her. Lisa Montgomery extracted the fetus, cut the umbilical cord, and left with the baby wrapped in a blanket. She entered her car and drove away to Kansas, holding the baby in her arms and pinching the umbilical cord. She clamped it, cleaned the baby girl with wipes, and called her husband. We already know what happened next. After confessing and being arrested, Lisa was charged with the federal offense of kidnapping resulting in death. For a crime that is pretty horrific and with a confession, a lot of people think there is no need to go to trial and to know more about the perpetrator. But in this case, the prosecutor was asking for the death penalty. This is extremely important because in all capital trials in the United States, there is a guilt phase and a sentencing phase. An accused being found guilty is not enough for them to be sentenced to death. The prosecutor needs to prove aggravating factors, and the defense brings mitigations. This is why we need to look into the defendants' lives and try to gather who they are, even when we are looking at the worst crimes. Lisa's mother, Judy Shaughnessy, was 20 at the time of her birth in 1968, and she drank heavily while pregnant with her, causing Lisa to be born with brain damage. Her father, John Patterson, was 25 years old and also an alcoholic. Not sure what happened with her dad, but her mom married about 6 times and always had men around. Lisa was raised in an abusive household. When Lisa was a small child, Judy allowed in men to rape her for money, including allowing her to be gang raped on multiple occasions, telling Lisa she had to earn her keep. For years, a stepfather was raping her too. She turned to alcohol to escape the dire reality. When Lisa was 14 or 15, her mother found out about the abuses. She walked in on her husband raping Lisa. Instead of trying to protect her child, she accused Lisa of seducing him and threatened her with a gun. Lisa developed multiple mental disorders, including bipolar disorder, temporal lobe epilepsy, dissociative disorder, and complex post-traumatic stress disorder, and lost touch with reality. As a teenager, Lisa confided in her cousin, a deputy sheriff, that she was being raped by her mother's new husband and other men, orally, vaginally, and anally. She said it was over and over, one man right after the other, and went on for hours, a cousin said in a sworn statement. They were also physically violent. They would beat and slap her if she was doing it wrong. When they were done, they urinated on her like she was trash. Lisa tried to escape the situation when she was 18 by getting married to a stepbrother, but her marriage and the following marriage resulted in even more abuses. She gave birth to 4 children in less than 5 years, before she went through the tubal litigation that left her sterile. According to sworn statements from her family, her mental health declined rapidly after that. She got into multiple car accidents, struggled to keep a job, moved around constantly, drank heavily, engaged in sex work, and neglected her children. She was often spaced out, appearing disconnected from reality. In spite of her 1990 tubal litigation, which, just to be clear, is basically sterilization, she faked pregnancy 2 times while married to her first husband, Carl Bowman. They divorced in 1998 and Lisa remarried to Kevin Montgomery. At the time of Bobby Joe's murder, Lisa and Carl Bowman were in a custody battle, and she knew he was about to out her about all the lies and fake pregnancies to prove her an unfit mother. Now remember, she was faking a pregnancy again with Kevin, and her supposed due date was coming up. She was not focused on proving him wrong. At her trial, the prosecution presented this as a motive for the murder. Her husband, Kevin, poor man, was absolutely clueless, testified that she claimed to be pregnant 3 times in total. The first 2 times, in 2000 and 2002, there would have been something wrong with the fetuses and she miscarried or needed an abortion. The third time, Kevin didn't question anything when Lisa called him to say she delivered. He had apparently been informed of the tubal litigation, but explained he didn't know what it meant. And I guess he didn't care enough to ask. Also, he trusted his wife. At the end of the day, why would he not? When Lisa was arrested, it was concluded that Kevin had no involvement or knowledge of the crime, and he was not charged with anything. Lisa, we know, was charged with kidnapping resulting in death. Here is the indictment. Lisa Montgomery willfully and unlawfully kidnapped, abducted, carried away, and held Victoria Justinet for the purpose and benefit of claiming Victoria Justinet as her child, and willfully transported Victoria Justinet in interstate commerce from Skidmore, Missouri, across the state line to Malvern, Kansas, the action of the defendant resulting in the death of Bobby Justinet. The superseding indictment further alleged statutory aggravating factors, including that Montgomery killed Stinnett in an especially heinous, cruel, and depraved manner in that it involved serious physical abuse to Stinnett. Thereafter, the government filed its notice of intent to seek the death penalty. At her trial, a neuropsychologist testified in her defense that previous head injuries might have damaged the part of the brain that controls aggression. It was also suggested that Montgomery suffered from pseudocyesis, a mental condition where women falsely believe they are pregnant and even exhibit signs of pregnancy, in addition to depression, borderline personality disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Rosen Ketchmark was an assistant U.S. attorney on Lisa's trial.
Pseudocyesis is really the foundation is 3 factors. That you truly believe you're pregnant, that you have a sincere craving, intense desire to be pregnant, and that you have the physical signs of pregnancy. And we were able to show that all 3 of those were lacking.
Because Lisa approached Bobby Joe with a fake name and watched videos of cesarean just before a trip to Skidmore, it was not hard for the prosecution to prove premeditation. The jury rejected this insanity defense, and on October 22, 2007, she was found guilty of a federal kidnapping resulting in death, and at the sentencing phase, the jury recommended a death sentence. This was upheld by the judge overseeing the case, and on April 4, 2008, Lisa Montgomery was officially given a death sentence for the death of Bobby Justinet. She became the 3rd woman sentenced to death under the federal system. Despite the outcome, her following lawyers kept working on the mental illness angle for her appeals and expressed that her previous attorneys provided incompetent defense and that her past trauma and mental illnesses were not fully revealed to the jury. Her sister, Diane Mattingly, became her advocate and wrote articles and told their story.
People need to see her on what had happened to her. They need to understand the pain that had been inflicted, years and years of childhood abuse, years and years of sexual abuse, years of rape. I mean, a child being raped. I was raped. But I got love after that happened, so it helped me heal faster. But she did not have that. There was somebody that is in the family that was a police officer that she went to and told that this was happening, and they did nothing.
In October 2020, Lisa's execution was announced for December 8, 2020. Her lawyers contracted COVID-19 while working and were unable to give her a good representation at that time and filed for a stay. Her attorney, Killing Henry, who is a death penalty lawyer veteran with over 20 years of experience, says that Lisa deserves to live because she is mentally ill and suffered childhood abuse. She explained,
Lisa's case is a case about not only about her trauma, but about how we in our systemic structures failed her, and therefore by extension failed Mrs. Stinnett. Lisa told people what was happening. Social workers, you know, came to the house and saw the conditions under which she lived and didn't step in. Neighbors knew. If someone had just stepped in at some point to save her from, you know, the hell that she was experiencing at the hands of her mother, trafficking her to these men to be gang raped, or if someone had stepped in and, you know, treated her mental illness, Mrs. Stinnett would be alive and Lisa would be, you know, on the outside world with her children.
She added, Lisa Montgomery has long accepted full responsibility for her crime, and she will never leave prison. But her severe mental illness and the devastating impacts of her childhood trauma make executing her a profound injustice. Amy Howell, a federal public defender in Tennessee, who is also working on Lisa Montgomery's case, confirmed her remorse. Mrs. Montgomery was psychotic at the time of the crime. She has always accepted responsibility. This is someone who was deeply remorseful once she became appropriately medicated and had full contact with reality. Although this is a situation that waxes and wanes. On November 23, 2020, Lisa Montgomery was given a new execution date of January 12, 2021. This is it for this case. Let me know what you think of Lisa Montgomery's sentence and of the federal execution spree. Thank you for listening, and I'll catch you in my next episode. This is a February 2021 update on the case. Lisa Montgomery was executed on January 13, 2021. She was 52 years old, 13 years spent on death row. In reality, she was in a federal medical center in Texas all those years and was transported to Terre Haute on Monday 11th at night. Because the penitentiary is a male facility, Lisa was housed in the execution facility as the only inmate there. There was a huge advocating effort that her life was spared for being a victim of many crimes herself, including a lifetime of sexual abuses. However, the victim's family and the Skidmore community refused the idea that she deserved any mercy. They also believed the execution would bring them closure. Despite a series of court orders that blocked, postponed, and ultimately delayed her execution, the Supreme Court cleared the way and the execution took place. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, Lisa was wearing a face mask in the execution chamber. It was removed when she was asked if she had any last word, to which she responded, no. She was pronounced dead at 11:31 a.m. at the Terre Haute Federal Prison Complex. As I said at the beginning of this episode, there had not been any federal execution in 17 years until this Trump spree that started in July 2020. Lisa were the 11th, and two more followed, those of Corey Johnson and Dustin Hicks. Attorney Kelly Henry, who tested positive for COVID-19 after visiting Lisa, called the executions super spreader events that demonstrated the administration's reckless disregard for human life of innocent citizens. Because this administration was so afraid that the next one might choose life over death, they put the lives and health of U.S. citizens in grave danger, she said. We should recognize Lisa Montgomery's execution for what it was, the vicious, unlawful, and unnecessary exercise of authoritarian power. We cannot let this happen again. During his presidential campaign, Joe Biden said he would put an end to the federal death penalty and try to influence the different states to follow. Less than a month before the execution, Victoria Jo Stinnett turned 16, the 16th anniversary of her mother's brutal death. Thank you for listening to this episode of True Crime Minutes. Please take the time to subscribe wherever you are listening. You can also stay in touch on Twitter at True Crime Min and Instagram at True Crime Minutes. Until next time, stay safe.